You know, there is this specific type of firework used in big professional displays called a salute shell.
Oh, right. The ones that just make that massive booming sound.
Exactly. It isn't designed to give you a pretty lingering shower of colorful sparks or anything like that. You light the fuse, it shoots up, and the chemical composition, which is usually this heavy dose of flash powder, is engineered to do just one thing.
To detonate with absolute blinding violence.
Yes, it consumes its entire casing in a fraction of a second. Just gone.
I mean, it creates a shockwave you can physically feel in your chest. It's breathtaking, really.
Right.
But the chemistry that creates that overwhelming blast is the exact same mechanism that guarantees its immediate destruction.
Right.
You can't have a slow-burning salute shell. The brilliance and the obliteration are the exact same thing.
And that tension, you know, between absolute world-changing brilliance and inevitable self-destruction is exactly what we're exploring today. Welcome to today's deep dive.
I'd be here.
So we are looking through a stack of source material from the history of rock and roll radio show today. And our mission is to examine the explosive, brief, and just completely legendary lifespan of the band Cream.
It is a story that almost defies logic, honestly, especially when you measure their cultural footprint against the actual time they managed to tolerate being in the same room together.
Right. Here is the premise, just to set the stakes for you listening. Cream is widely regarded as the world's first successful supergroup. In their insanely short career, they sold over 15 million records worldwide.
Which was unheard of.
Totally. They scored the world's very first platinum-selling double album. They essentially laid the mechanical and musical groundwork for everyone from Led Zeppelin to the Allman Brothers to Rush.
They really did.
They achieved absolute musical immortality. And yet, they existed for barely 2 years, 24 months.
It's crazy.
How does a band fundamentally change the trajectory of rock and roll while simultaneously imploding from day one? Okay, let's unpack this.
Well, to understand the implosion, we can't just look at their breakup. We really have to look at the ingredients they were mixing back in 1966. The seeds of their destruction were literally the foundational pillars of the band.
So let's look at the landscape of 1966. You have Eric Clapton. At this point, thanks to his time with the Yardbirds and John Mayall's band, he has this godlike reputation in Britain.
Right, the Clapton is God graffiti.
Exactly. But he's feeling confined by the strict structures of traditional blues. He wants a new environment where he can really stretch out as a guitarist.
And enter Ginger Baker. Baker is a phenomenally talented jazz and R&B drummer, but he's in a similar boat. He's the leader of the Graham Bond organization, but he has grown entirely exhausted.
As a Graham Bond, right?
Yeah, Graham Bond was struggling with severe drug addictions and intense bouts of mental instability. Baker was just desperate for an exit strategy.
So these two cross paths, and Baker asks Clapton to form a new, unnamed band with him. Clapton is completely on board, but he has one strict, non-negotiable condition. He tells Baker, "I will do it, but you have to hire Jack Bruce as our bassist and vocalist."
And when Clapton drops that ultimatum, Ginger Baker is supposedly so shocked by the suggestion that he almost crashes the car he's driving.
Which sounds like pure rock and roll mythology until you actually look at the history between Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce. They had both been in the Graham Bond organization together.
Oh, and we aren't talking about mild creative differences here. We are talking about a violently toxic relationship. They had literal physical fist fights on stage during performances.
Wait, on stage? While playing?
Yes, they would intentionally sabotage each other's instruments mid-song. It culminated in Baker actually firing Bruce from the band. But Bruce just kept showing up to the gigs anyway, plugging in his bass and playing.
I mean, that is a staggering level of petty.
It became a standoff of sheer stubbornness. Bruce refused to accept the firing, so Baker escalated the situation to a terrifying degree. He ultimately drove Jack Bruce away by threatening him at knife point.
At knife point, I mean, think about that. We've all been in that terrible group project at work or school where people passive aggressively refuse to share the spotlight.
Oh, for sure.
Imagine that, but your coworker is literally holding a blade to you. Yet, Clapton, who had played briefly with Bruce and was blown away by his technical prowess, insisted on him.
So Baker and Bruce somehow agree to put the knives away, literally, for the sake of this new trio. They briefly considered naming the band Sweet and Sour Rock and Roll.
Which is probably the most honest name a band has ever almost chosen.
Definitely. But they settle on Cream because all three of them were universally considered the cream of the crop amongst musicians in the British scene. It's a calculated risk.
They envisioned a band that was purely collaborative, suppressing their hatred for the sake of musical elevation, like locking volatile chemicals in a room.
What's fascinating here is how shared, overwhelming ambition operates. They all knew how masterful the others were. For a brief window, the desire to create something unprecedented overrode the fact that two-thirds of the rhythm section despised each other.
But having a truce doesn't write songs. I mean, how do three massive egos figure out what they're actually going to play? They didn't just walk out of the gate as progressive rock gods.
No, not at all.
When you look at the timeline, they really had to stumble into their iconic sound.
Right, they had a very practical problem. They were a brand new band without a catalog. Their unofficial debut was at the Twisted Wheel in July 1966, followed by their official debut at the Windsor Jazz and Blues Festival.
And to fill a set list, they had to rely heavily on reworking traditional blues standards because they just didn't have the material yet.
Exactly. That bought them time to record their debut album, Fresh Cream, later that year. And you can hear them testing the waters there. It's a split between blues covers and originals.
But you also get a track like Toad. This is Ginger Baker expanding on a song he wrote in 1965, and by doing so, he delivers one of the earliest examples of a standalone drum solo in rock music.
He's bringing jazz soloing concepts into a heavy blues rock format. But the real stress test of this truce happens when they try to conquer the United States in March of 1967.
Right, they go to New York.
They go to New York to play the RKO 58th Street Theater. And keep in mind the context here. Clapton is a deity in England, but he left the Yardbirds before their music really hit the U.S. top 10 to the American mainstream. He's a nobody.
And the promoter, Murray the K, treats them like nobodies. He puts Cream at the absolute bottom of a six-act bill. They have to perform three times a day.
That's exhausting.
It is. And eventually, their set gets reduced to playing just one single song per concert. Imagine the absolute blow to the egos of the quote-unquote cream of the crop flying across the Atlantic just to be treated as filler.
But the humiliation kept them hungry. They stayed in New York, and in May of 1967, they went into Atlantic Studios with producer Felix Pappalardi and engineer Tom Dowd. This session produces their second album, Disraeli Gears.
This is where the alchemy actually happens. They blend their British psychedelic rock influences with heavy American blues.
And out of that session comes Sunshine of Your Love. This song is the perfect illustration of the pressure cooker they were in. It wasn't born from some relaxed, inspired jam session where they were all grooving together.
Not at all. It came from pure, bleary-eyed exhaustion.
Bruce and lyricist Pete Brown had been up all night in Bruce's apartment. They were trying to write something, trying to find a spark, and coming up completely empty. It is the wee hours of the morning.
In an absolute last-ditch effort to salvage a fruitless night, Bruce just picks up his double bass and plays a heavy descending riff.
And Brown happens to look out the window, sees the sun actually starting to come up, and just mutters, "It's getting near dawn."
He literally wrote down what was physically happening in front of his tired eyes. It's an incredibly grounded origin for what would become a cornerstone of psychedelic rock.
Even the visual identity of the band was shifting. The record label delayed the release of Disraeli Gears for months simply because they decided to scrap the original cover.
Oh, wow.
They commissioned artist Martin Sharp to create a wild, fluorescent, psychedelic design painted right over a publicity photo of the trio. It signaled a huge departure from the sharp-suited blues purists they had been.
But I actually want to pause here and look at a contradiction in the source material regarding their live shows.
Okay, well, let's hear it.
Because you constantly hear this mythology about Cream being these grand avant-garde visionaries who invented the long-form rock jam on purpose. But if you listen to early bootlegs, they were tight. They played short, punchy, 5-minute versions of their songs.
That changes when they start headlining U.S. dates in late summer 1967 at places like the Fillmore in San Francisco. They encounter the flourishing hippie counterculture.
Right, but my pushback is that they didn't start doing 20-minute improvisations because they had some grand artistic vision for the future of music.
You think it was just practical?
Yeah, they did it because this American hippie audience expected long, drawn-out experiences, and frankly, the band needed to fill the time on these longer headlining sets. I think they adapted out of pure necessity, and it just happened to become their signature move.
I see the argument, but I would argue the execution validates the myth. Plenty of bands tried to stretch a 3-minute song into 20 minutes to appease that Fillmore crowd, and it usually resulted in a boring, repetitive mess.
It's very true.
Cream had the rare technical virtuosity to actually sustain a 20-minute jam. Usually, a rhythm section is the safety net that catches the lead guitarist. In Cream, the bassist and the drummer were trying to do backflips at the exact same time as the guitarist.
So if anyone loses their timing, the whole song just plummets to the ground.
Exactly.
That's a fair point. They were doing a high wire act without a net and surviving it night after night.
And by surviving it, they became the perfect bridge for that specific cultural moment. The music industry was transitioning from strict packaged pop acts to free-form counterculture. Cream could straddle both the tight pop single on the radio and the sprawling psychedelic experience on stage.
Which brings us to the irony of 1968. That massive success of Disraeli Gears gave them a blank check, which led to their magnum opus, Wheels of Fire.
It is a monumental release. It becomes the world's very first platinum-selling double album.
One disc is studio recordings. The second disc is live recordings captured at the Winterland Ballroom and the Fillmore.
Musically, they are pushing way past traditional blues into a semi-progressive rock style. You get tracks like White Room, which instantly dominates the radio.
That's a classic.
You get Politician, written while they were sitting around waiting to perform live at the BBC. They even included a cover of Albert King's Born Under a Bad Sign, mostly because the record company asked them to.
And the studio material shows them experimenting wildly. The notes mention they were playing with odd time signatures. For anyone listening who isn't a musician, what does that actually mean for the band?
Well, standard rock and pop music is usually in 4/4 time. You can count it easily. 1, 2, 3, 4. It feels like a natural heartbeat or walking.
Right. Very predictable.
Exactly. An odd time signature, like playing in 54 or 74, feels like you are walking up the stairs in the dark and you miss a step. It has a staggered, complex, cyclical groove.
Okay, I can picture that.
To play in an odd time signature, let alone improvise over it, requires an immense amount of communication and trust between the musicians.
Which is the ultimate tragic irony, because at the exact moment they are successfully pulling off these complex musical feats, at the moment they are holding a platinum double album and are universally revered, privately, the three of them have decided they are completely done with each other.
Yeah, by mid-1968, they all wanted to quit.
The double album format of Wheels of Fire is actually a symptom of their decay. The extended runtime allowed for endless drawn-out solos.
They no longer had to sit in a room together to craft tight, cohesive songs. They could simply use the loose framework of a song as an excuse to retreat into their own individual worlds on stage.
That is such a crucial insight. The source notes describe how they stopped playing with each other and started playing near each other.
Playing near each other. That's a great way to put it.
And that isolation turned right back into hostility. The old rivalry between Bruce and Baker flared right back up. Only this time, instead of knives, the weapon of choice was sheer volume.
To understand how a band breaks down over volume, you have to look at the technological advancements of the era. The mid to late 60s introduced the Marshall amplifier stack,
which changed everything.
Before this, bands mostly plugged into small combo amps, and the sound engineer pushed it through the venue's PA system.
The Marshall stack changed the literal physics of a live concert. You are stacking a powerful amplifier head on top of massive speaker cabinets. You aren't just making a sound louder, you are pushing a physical wall of air directly off the stage.
So Jack Bruce, playing the bass, starts pushing his volume levels higher and higher through these roaring stacks. The physical footprint of his sound was just overwhelming.
And poor Ginger Baker is sitting behind a traditional acoustic drum kit. He doesn't have an amplifier.
Right. He has to physically hit the drum skins hard enough to compete with a wall of overdriven electronics. It created immense physical strain and psychological tension for Baker.
It completely severed the communication of the band. Eric Clapton told a story that is the ultimate symptom of this dysfunction. He admitted that during one concert, the sheer wall of noise from Bruce and Baker was so deafening and their playing was so self-indulgent that Clapton just stopped playing his guitar completely.
He literally took his hands off the strings.
And neither Baker nor Bruce even noticed. They were so locked into their own sonic battles, their own ego trips, that the lead guitarist simply dropping out didn't even register.
It's the worst dinner party imaginable. You have three incredibly charismatic people sitting at a table, shouting their own separate stories at the exact same time, at the top of their lungs, completely ignoring whatever anyone else is saying.
It's deafening, it's chaotic, and it just cannot last.
We often idolize absolute technical proficiency in our culture. But when you are universally recognized as the cream of the crop, who is left to check your ego?
That's a great question.
When everyone on stage is a master who takes on the humble, crucial role of saying, hey, maybe we should turn the amplifiers down and actually serve the song.
Nobody does. And so the salute shell burns itself out. In July of 1968, while they are on top of the world, they officially announce they are breaking up.
They agree to a farewell tour of the U.S., two final concerts in London, and they are persuaded to record one final album, appropriately titled Goodbye.
Goodbye was released in early 1969, after the band had officially ceased to exist. It was a mix of live tracks from the Forum in Los Angeles and a few new studio recordings.
Most notably, the track Badge, which Clapton actually co-wrote.
Even that farewell tour was steeped in chaotic, resentful energy. They played 22 shows in the U.S. Their final American gig was at the Rhode Island Auditorium on November 4th, 1968.
And in classic dysfunctional Cream fashion, they arrived late.
Of course they did.
Because of local curfews, they were only allowed to perform two songs. Instead of playing their tight hits, they obstinately played Toad, and then a sprawling 20-plus minute version of Spoonful.
It was a perfectly arrogant and frustrating way to say goodbye to America.
Their actual final performances were at the Royal Albert Hall in London on November 25th and 26th, 1968.
And there is a beautiful, poetic passing of the torch here. The opening act for those final shows was a progressive rock band that had formed just 3 months earlier. Yes.
Wow. The old guard burning out after 2 years, making way for the next evolution of complex rock music.
So when we step back, what is the ultimate takeaway for you, the listener? How do we quantify the impact of just 24 months?
Mechanically, they changed how instruments were played. Along with Jimi Hendrix, Cream popularized the use of the wah-wah pedal.
For those unfamiliar, this is a pedal that sweeps the peak response of a frequency filter up and down. It literally mimics the human voice saying wah.
They took the electric guitar from a rhythmic instrument and turned it into a vocalizer. Beyond the pedals, they laid the heavy, technically demanding groundwork that would directly spawn British heavy metal.
Bands like Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, and Black Sabbath in the 1970s.
Exactly. Their influence deeply impacted American Southern rock groups like the Allman Brothers Band, and the sheer ambition of their complex live performances became the blueprint for progressive rock giants.
They were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1993, which is an incredible legacy for essentially 2 years of work. But I think the real lesson here goes beyond music. It's a profound lesson in collaboration for any field.
Individual brilliance, no matter how staggering, can only take a project so far if the team fundamentally stops listening to one another.
Once the respect is gone, once volume is used simply to drown out your partner, the end is inevitable.
It is a stark cautionary tale about the limits of talent without trust.
But it also leaves me with a lingering, almost provocative thought for you to ponder long after we wrap up here. Given how incredibly fast they burned out, is it possible that Cream had to break up when they did in order to achieve this legendary status?
That shifts the perspective entirely.
Think about it. If they had somehow forced themselves to stay together, if they had compromised those massive egos to keep the peace, would the music have suffered?
Would they have lost that dangerous edge and just slowly faded into mediocrity over the 1970s?
We always assume in life that longevity is the ultimate goal, but perhaps in art, longevity is sometimes the enemy of perfection. Maybe the explosion was the whole point.
They gave the world exactly what they had, uncompromised, and left the stage before they could water down their own legacy.
So the next time you hear that descending bass riff on Sunshine of Your Love, I encourage you to listen with new ears. Picture Jack Bruce, exhausted at dawn, striking that note.
Picture the roaring Marshall stacks pushing a wall of air.
And the sheer volatility of three absolute masters holding a high wire act together just long enough to change music history before the casing burned away. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
Keep listening, keep questioning, and we'll see you next time.
Take care, everyone.